and welcome to Accurate Squad with Christian Lander. Today I am talking with Sam O'Hara-Childs, who takes on the lead role in the new independent fan production of Marvel Comics' Union Jack, available from this week on YouTube, Halloween, formerly Brexit Day. So without further ado, let's dive right in and roll with the conversation.
Yes, which is great. It's been such a lot of work and so long in the making. It's great to finally see it out there and people responding so positively. Yeah, it's really good. Very exciting.
Union Jack, of course, so episode one aired this week, and I'm assuming that's going to be like a rolling rollout of episodes? Like, is it a weekly thing you're going to be doing?
Yeah, it'll be broadcast weekly on YouTube at Union Jack the series. The first episode, like you say, was this Thursday just gone. Excuse me, and then it will be broadcast every Thursday for 10 weeks until the 2nd of January. So it's a 10-part series.
That's what I was going to query, is how many episodes is actually going to be in total. But 10 episodes is good, because I think there's this kind of like Americanized serialization of shows where it runs for like 24, 26 episodes. But it's kind of a UK way, 10 episodes or 6 to 10 is the kind of sweet spot where you can actually get in a whole story. It doesn't feel like it's bloated, and everything is in there. So was that, like, intentional from the beginning to have, like, just a short-run series?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, often in the UK it's between 6 to 10 episodes. With the comics, with the series, and with it being derived from the comics, there's so much material in the comics and various different versions and iterations of the character and different places he pops up across the gamut of Marvel, the Marvel Universe in the comics. There's so much to choose from and draw from that it was hard to squeeze it all in to 6. So we thought that 10 would give it enough of a sort of surface area to sprawl out over to fit in the various plot twists and various Marvel Easter eggs and to bulk out all the various characters enough and provide twists and turns and make it as comprehensive a show as possible, basically, about the character. That was the intention with that. 6 we felt was too short, and 10's a nice round number. I mean, originally it was going to be 9 and kind of 3 blocks of 3.
Okay.
But then in the end, we felt that 10 was better and a more rounded number to kind of tie up all the plot points and do the most comprehensive job.
So with that, with that 10 episode, or originally 9 episode layout, I mean, how far did production go back before, you know, you guys got a camera in front of an actor? And so how long was production kind of thought of to go ahead?
Well, about 2 or 3 years, I think, was when the sort of the seed of the idea was planted in the director's head, the writer and director, Mark Garvey, and he tried to make it before, but then things hadn't quite worked out, and then he was looking for an actor, and then I got in touch with a friend of his, another actor in the show, and a behind-the-scenes guy as well called Simon Cleary. He plays Gavin in the show.
Yeah.
I was talking to him about something else completely separate, and then he mentioned they were doing the show, and he thought I sounded like I had the verve to play the part, I think were his words. And then I got in touch with Mark, sent him over a picture and a video of some of my other work, and then we took it from there. So I think, about 2 or 3 years before we got me in front of a camera, he'd had the idea. It was such an ambitious show to try and pull off. It had taken a while to get all the ducks in a row and the pieces aligned to actually make it.
Yeah, because I guess, I mean, I've actually been quite a fan of fan productions for probably 10, 15 years now, all the different various ones that are out there. You know, how an independent team could take an IP, say like Star Trek or Star Wars, or I guess the most popular ones, and actually, you know, create something new, original, but is always faithful to its original IP. I mean, I guess when I was watching this, I mean, I'm aware of Union Jack in its Marvel context and when he pops up, and I was actually quite impressed to see it on the screen and going, you know, I can see that sense of humour is actually resonating really well, and it is a really good homage and a development of those original comics. And I guess, looking at Union Jack as a character, it's surprising they haven't done it already on the big screen or even as a TV series. So I'm actually really glad that this one's come off the ground. And was there any kind of attempt to contact Disney and Marvel to say, hey, would you give us a thumbs up about this?
Well, obviously it's a tricky one because, you know, there's various copyright issues involved with the IP. So the general view of the director and the rest of the team was to make it and, you know, still bring it to as wide an audience attention as possible and industry attention, but try not to kind of ruffle the feathers of Marvel or Disney themselves. And when it comes to getting interest, obviously it'd be fantastic if Marvel, Kevin Feige saw it and wanted to offer us the chance to take it further, either as a Netflix series or as a Marvel Cinematic Universe film, because we think obviously it would really work. That's why we made the series in the first place. And like you say, that blend of the kind of Marvel style, the tone of a Marvel film or a Marvel series, definitely with the comedy, I think blends really well with the British comedic sensibilities. Very,
it does, yeah, particularly
sarcastic and knowing and that kind of almost in a way indefinable British tone. A lot of it's, you know, sarcasm and quite dry wit, yeah, and a bit of the kind of British underdog spirit, kind of, you know, plucky swinging for the fences, even if you're vastly outnumbered. That's obviously quite a British thing as well.
It is, yeah. You're right, that does lend itself really well. I guess perhaps the problem would be that the American style of filmmaking or film telling doesn't lend itself well to that sensibility of attitude. It would probably have to be made by a British team who understood that sense of humour.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting, it's a good question. It's an interesting conundrum. You'd think, yeah, if Marvel executives got behind it in terms of funding and, you know, marketing heft and employed a British team or a team that really understood what the British sensibilities are in terms of the core of the character and to represent British culture on the big screen and on a big stage, that would make sense in order to pull it all together in a similar way, excuse me, to how they did Black Panther.
Yeah.
With, you know,
a majority of black cast who are predominantly,
excuse me, yes, but, yeah. African-American director, largely African-American cast or African cast or Afro-Anglo, Afro-English, by short the term is cast. To give it that sense of authenticity and people can really get under the skin of the experience of the culture of where the character is drawn and derived from. So I think if they approached it in a similar way, Marvel say, and employed sort of British people in the principal positions of cast and crew, that it would work.
Yes, and maybe they should, like, employ, like, John Cleese and the rest of the Monty Python crew.
Yeah, maybe. That could work. That could work.
Superhero Monty Python. You know, I'm sure there's a sketch in there for that.
Yeah, I think always chucking in one of the Pythons to, you know, to a show like this is some kind of, I don't know, bumbling or super tetchy authoritative figure.
Yeah.
Has been done quite often. John Cleese obviously has done it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, many times. I think he would work in some kind of senior MI5 position, something like that.
I could see that working quite well, actually, yeah.
Yeah, very put upon boss, telling, you know, tearing his hair out or some, could be perhaps a prime minister or a minister, completely baffled by this person's vigilante, reckless, scallywag antics.
But I guess he always gets the job done and goes home to the wife and tries, the character, of course, balancing home life, work life, and the superhero life at the same time. Right? That's actually one of the things I actually really like about the character of Union Jack. And I guess, is there going to be like anything tying into other characters, potentially, who are in the Marvel sphere? Or will it mainly just be focused on this particular character?
Well, you'll have to see with regard to that. I don't want to give away too much.
Spoilers.
Definitely plenty of nods and Easter eggs in there. And I can definitely say for sure that the wider Marvel universe is explored.
Okay.
And we do draw from various pockets and niches of it, mainly the British characters.
Okay.
But there's so many that people who aren't, you know, super into Marvel, they wouldn't have heard of them. But a lot of people who read Marvel comics, especially British comic fans, would know about and have probably been longing to see on the big screen for a while, on screen for a while. There's plenty coming up, and plenty of, like I say, ways we tried to cram as much in as we possibly could to the 10 episodes.
So all 10 episodes have actually gone through principal photography, they've gone through development, they're already complete, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So how long did that production then take? So how long was the filming schedule? How long did it take to get everything principally filmed?
The filming schedule told was, I think, about 14 months.
Okay.
Yeah, quite a long time.
What's a bit, if you're filming, like, so were you filming, like, per episode individually, or were you filming multiple shots for a certain scene for multiple episodes?
Yeah, we filmed over the span of the entire canvas of the show, so it could be in one day we'd film 8 or even a dozen scenes at max, maybe scattered throughout the entire series.
Okay.
So it could be quite hard to keep track of where we were and what we were doing at times, because there's so much to do every single time we shot.
Well, were you involved with the production as well as the just the on-screen?
I wasn't really involved with the production. Well, I didn't have any set production roles. I kind of assisted with a few costume ideas, script ideas, casting ideas. Me and the director, Mark, worked quite closely on, because me and him were the main two ones at the helm of it, spent a lot of time together. We discuss things more or less constantly, but nothing in an official capacity.
I got you.
Yeah, just kind of because I was so ever present on the shoot, I had lots of ideas to contribute as well. And I've made my own films in the past and done lots of other kinds of performance, so I had plenty of ideas to contribute.
So what were the products of you put together in the past?
Well, I've made short films myself for the internet, mainly comedy.
Okay.
I've made... Void we made, which was a cop show film noir parody, which was a lot of fun. Topical Fruit, which was a topical sketch show. And all of those have been very kind of very focused on genre and genre parodies. So that was kind of one of the appeals of doing Union and Jack for me, was I've done similar work in the past. Obviously, it's not strictly a genre parody. It's kind of a pastiche and a homage, obviously, to the Marvel genre. And because it's so tongue-in-cheek, and it's a fan series, and it's very low budget, it kind of has almost a feeling of a plucky, subversive parody about it.
Yeah. I got that there was, I don't know if it was intentional, I kind of got the vibe of, like, Shaun of the Dead, the Hot Fuzz style, you know, where you've got almost characters who are in a situation that is, they're quite real, quite visceral, normal people, yet they're in this kind of, like, supernatural, over-the-top environment where they're kind of dealing with it as guys do at the pub. You know, there was the particular scene where you, I think it's like the character Gavin, you guys are, you're at the pub, and you go out and you go back to the manor, and there's the vampire outside. I thought that was felt very much like Edgar Wright's kind of style, and that felt really comfortable to watch. It was quite, really quite funny. The banter you guys had off each other was good.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, it has that kind of gritty, realistic, almost kitchen sink feel to it. And like you say, because I had to go back and see my girlfriend and get the shopping, things like that. But that's trying to play to the strengths of the show. And obviously, parody is kind of the wrong word. It's just our own British low-budget riff on the genre in the same way that, say, Shaun of the Dead is of the zombie genre.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very... It really tries to get under the skin of what it means to be British and what the British would do if they're faced with a crisis. And even if it isn't huge, crazy scale, we took it to the biggest scale and the biggest heights that we could and try to still do it authentically as they do with Shaun of the Dead. So the horror is still real. The violence is still real. You know, the characters, the pathos is still real. But it's all navigated and confronted in a very British way, with a very dry, sarcastic, sometimes slapdash or slapstick sense of humour.
Yeah, so you mentioned there about the violence. I mean, obviously, you're quite physical. You know, obviously, the workout in the gym, you know, you appear to be a kind of guy who's, you know, in really good shape. I mean, did you get into better shape for the role as you knew that was coming into production? Did you hit the gym more often, and was that part of it?
I did, yes. I set myself quite a rigorous training programme to try and get into as best shape as possible for it and then maintain it over the course of the show. Which was doable, and I did to enough of a standard for myself, but it was still tricky because, I mean, I was getting fatigued with the sheer amount of physical work there was to do and getting injured, pulling muscles, or I pulled my rotator cuffs, I pulled a tendon. And when you are pulling muscles and then, you know, and then going to work and then going back out to film, sometimes it's hard to squeeze in the gym.
Yeah.
But I did all I could. And definitely into the run-up to the show, I really hit the gym hard to get into as best shape as possible. Yeah, because, you know, the whole point was to still, even though it's, like we've just talked about there, British, realistic, kind of gritty, feet-on-the-ground riff on the Marvel genre and tone, I still wanted to be authentic enough. Like I said, they're about the kind of authentic horror and violence you find in Shaun of the Dead, and we tried to evoke in our series as well. I wanted to still look like a superhero, as much like a superhero or a hero and a man of action as, you know, as much as possible, to be convincing, to look heroic, even if many of the things I do are reckless or ill thought through, to still make the character heroic enough so that it was believable. And because the mantle of the show kind of is on my shoulders, I wanted to make sure they were broad, very well-defined shoulders.
So is martial arts something you're interested in overall? I mean, is that like an interest you have?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I got quite a lot. I'd always had an interest in martial arts, and I got into jiu-jitsu and boxing for the role.
Okay.
And took some screen combat classes as well to make sure my reactions, both my reactions in taking hits and my actions in giving the hits, were convincing enough. Because obviously there has to be a certain way you hit and take the hits.
Yes.
You broadcast it to enough of a scale when it's on screen to make sure that it looks believable and kind of, but also larger than life, because it's comic book and because I'm fighting vampires and they have supernatural speed and I'm supposed to be a hero and heroic, that I'm able to take them on. So it has to be big enough. I worked hard at that as well.
Yeah, because it's about like on-screen martial arts is an interesting thing. I mean, I'm a martial arts instructor. Like I was when I was like 19 and 20 years old. I was teaching kickboxing and taekwondo, and I went on to teach karate afterwards. As I've grown up and I've evolved through like grappling arts, and I did like some MMA stuff. Seeing on-screen fights is really interesting because you're thinking, oh, would a guy do that? Is that the angle that it is?
Yeah.
But the way that it's filmed, it just in general, the way that fights are made in films, I guess the Bourne evolution, you know, the movie, the Bourne films with Matt Damon.
Yeah.
How they film that kind of up close, interpersonal kind of I guess intimate action. You know, it kind of changed how fights were seen on screen after that.
Yes. Point. Yeah. Well, yeah, we were going for a similar kinetic, visceral style and kind of a street fighting style as well. I mean, the idea of Union Jack, you know, I generally take a boxing stance, and boxing is, as a character, and boxing is what I do, but then I use any parts of my body that become available. Because I'm fighting vampires who move in very strange and frenzied ways, I often have to improvise. So it's kind of a, you know, a kitchen sink, throw the kitchen sink approach to fighting, do whatever it takes. You know, it's just, it's quite scrappy and messy and visceral, as I said, and just doing whatever it takes to get the job done, which is the character's general approach to everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is certainly how is his mannerisms and behaviour is. I mean, so 10 episodes. I mean, so have you got anything lined up after? Is it now you've wrapped up and the film is obviously going to be coming out over the next 10 weeks? Have you got anything else lined up film wise that you're working on?
Not at present. No, I'm planning to start a podcast myself.
Okay.
And I have a novel that I've written, and I plan to work further on that and to send that off to agents. It's about a Tesco delivery man who has the worst night of his life. It's a very outrageous farce, not too far a cry from the kind of tone of Union Jack and other projects I've done in the past. And obviously,
I was going to say, so in my head, I don't know why I'm thinking this, I can just see this kind of Tesco delivery driver. He kind of arrives at a house, and like the most crazy kind of things has happened, like a murder or something, and he's following us.
Yeah, you're not far off, although even crazier than that. And obviously, I want to push the acting as well and see what opportunities I can get from competing Union Jack, and see if I can go further afield in an acting sense to get roles on a bigger and bigger stage. That would be fantastic.
Is like a theatre that you've done in the past?
Theatre, yeah, I've done plenty of theatre and screen work as well, various short films.
Okay.
But I'd look to return to the stage and the screen.
Excellent, man, excellent. There's so much going on. The way that podcasts have evolved in, say, the last 10 years has been incredible, really. And what I find interesting about podcasts is that most people don't even know how to access them or even use them. So I think there's this whole kind of developing medium that has yet to be fully tapped, and I think it's going to explode even more so in the next, say, 5 to 10 years.
Yes, I think you're probably right. Yeah, it's still kind of catching on.
Yeah,
I think not everyone does know about it. Even if you try and explain it to them, they still have no idea what you're really talking about.
The way I describe it is it's like on-demand radio, but it is more than a radio could ever be.
Well, yeah, and obviously it's odd to anyone who's listened to them a lot in the past, which is, you know, a growing, not subculture, but a growing demographic and niche. You know, to those people, it's often a part of their daily existence. So if someone hasn't heard of it, unless they're 80, it always seems very odd.
Yeah, I mean, so do you listen to podcasts quite often?
I do, yes. I mean, you mentioned Joe Rogan. I'm a big fan of his. Boxing podcast as well, sports podcasts, culture podcasts, sort of philosophy and topical issues podcasts as well. There's a great one called Behind the Bastards, which is about... I think the strapline is the true story behind history's greatest monsters, and it's kind of ridiculous stories about... Yeah, I recommend it to quite a lot of people. It's like Hitler used to write fan fiction, Saddam Hussein used to write erotic novels. It's kind of ridiculous facts about...
Ooh, that's really interesting.
History's greatest tyrants, and it's it's very tongue-in-cheek, even if some parts of it are obviously very... horrific and haunting. Generally, they take a very subversive look at a lot of these people to make them very ridiculous, or to bring out the ridiculousness of their natures that were there anyway, but perhaps were not so well known.
No, that is really
a lot of fun, and obviously informative as well and educational.
Yeah, dude, I think I tend to listen to podcasts to and from my way to work, because the way that I'm positioned to my workplace, it's much easier just to take public transport, just like just a tram away. So I always listen to a podcast on the way to work, or if I'm at work and I've got the opportunity and no one's around, I've got my earphones in, or I'm at home and I put it through the Bluetooth speaker. And I think I consume more podcasts now than any other medium.
Yeah, it's just so easy to pop them on. You're doing the washing up, you're traveling or walking or doing pretty much anything, you know, organizing something about the house, doing admin, whatever it might be.
Yeah,
you can just have them on. I think it's one of the best resources and forms of media, like you say, most readily accessible and easily accompanying to pretty much every aspect of life that there is out there. So I'm sure it will be more and more people discover the benefits of it.
So how do you know when you talk about podcasts to people, what do you? I think they have a preconception that somehow they're actually an audiobook of some kind, and they go, oh, I don't listen to audiobooks. And you go, actually, well, it can be, but actually audio drama perhaps is a better take. It's not like, say, No Sleep Podcast or Byron Chronicles, or, you know, ones that are actually acted drama with almost a theatre, audio theatre. And then you have your audio books, effectively, that are literally just read verbatim out of a book. But then you have, like, documentaries, and you have... powerful films that are audio films. There's so many different ways that it can be envisioned and brought together as a production.
I mean, I generally say it's like your own private radio station.
Yeah.
And it can be on any theme or topic. I mean, that seems to make people understand a bit better. For some reason, people still find it hard. And until they actually hear one, they don't really understand it so much.
No, I think the accessibility is a bit of an odd one as well, because I guess... podcasts have really kind of started as, like, on iTunes, really. You know, that was the kind of, like, the first place you could access them in a singular place. So everyone had to think they had to have an Apple account to listen to a podcast. And then there was all these lots of different places that allowed you to host audio or, like, SoundCloud, etc. And that's changed, I'd say, the last maybe couple of years or so. It's now become really accessible. But the apps on phones there's so many that it's baffling for some people.
I think it is baffling, and it depends what people use their phones for as well. Some people obviously listen to music on Spotify, and I do that quite often myself as well, and a lot of podcasts are on Spotify too, so that works out well. some people use them, I don't know, to travel perhaps only, or finances, or scrolling through Facebook or Instagram. It could be principally what they use them for and don't often think about other uses, unless someone brings it to their attention.
It's true, you know, when you say that, because a lot of people, they have like an MP3 player and a phone, and aren't aware that they're doing the same thing. And it's like, come on, what are you doing? So they have like an iPod and a phone.
Yeah, well, I had a friend years ago said to me, you know, you should get an iPod. I was like, well, I have the phone, you know, why? And I generally try and be as efficient as possible. So, you know, if I can have everything on one device, I'll use that one device. It makes no sense to double up if I don't have to.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? People don't seem to realise that these devices do all the same things. It's like, nowadays phones are sold and they're how good the lens is or how good they can connect to the network of the 5G or whatever. And it's like, you got a whole device of everything in one machine. Use it.
Yeah, well, I think it can depend on, I don't know, how you approach the phone, as in how you approach the use of a phone in general terms, generally speaking. You know, some people try and get the absolute maximum out of it, maybe, or see how much they can explore the world through the one device, how much you can unlock and untap. And obviously, there's a hell of a lot that you can do. And I use my phone, I used it since last year as a digital notebook as well, and that's made everything hell of a lot more coordinated and organized. And I was like, why didn't I do this many, many years ago? This is insanely more efficient.
I'm exactly the same, I really am. I'm just, it is like, I use the keep.google.com, so I can get the browser, I use the app, and I can just sync all my calendar and my notes together, and no matter what device I go to, I can log in, and there they are. And that has just been a breath of fresh air.
Definitely. I mean, it makes life so much more coordinated at all times, and, you know, it could be something like, you know, I have friends and they might lose things, or where the hell is this bit of paperwork? I mean, I've scanned in most of my paperwork now as well, and I've put all my key details on the notebook too. And if someone's like, well, where's this, you know, what's the password to Netflix? We can never remember it. Well, it's like, well, I have it on my phone straight away. There you go.
That's true. I literally have I have a spreadsheet that I keep on my Google Docs for that. Again, I can access it anywhere, and it's got all my account details. Everywhere I go, I can just go, oh, there it is.
Or even shopping lists as well, or whatever. You know, say my mother always insists on writing things on paper, and it's endless post-it notes or scraps of paper. It's like, just write it on my phone, and then it's not. We're not drowning in endless, you know, confetti of scraps of paper. So much more organized. But it depends, you know, not everybody wants to change or use a phone for those purposes. Like I said, I think it depends how you approach your phone generally.
Yeah. Maybe the problem is we call it a phone these days. Maybe that needs to change.
That's actually a good point. You know, almost, I don't know, maybe, obviously you use various messaging services, but at least half the time I'm not using it to message, to contact anyone, probably, or to communicate.
Because obviously there's this quite, what's the word for it? I guess the zeitgeist is that everyone's sat there looking at their phone. But a lot of people looking at their phones for completely and utterly different reasons.
Yeah, that's the thing as well. It's, you know, you could be accused, especially by members of the older generation, of looking at their phone all the time. If it's, well, I'm actually doing a lot of organizing.
Yeah.
You know, very important administration about whatever aspect of life, then, you know, they can back off a bit. But if they don't know about that, they just harangue you for being on your phone like the rest of, well, the rest of the world, or the rest of the world as they see it, like, you know, the archetypal or stereotypical view of just people zombified staring into the abyss of their phones, looking at mindless bump, as opposed to actually organising a lot. I think there's that Indeed.co.uk advert at the moment. You've probably seen it.
Yeah.
With the kid who's on his phone, and the, you know, the parents sat around the table saying, you know, why aren't you going out there, sending out CVs, or looking for a job, and then he gets a notification on his phone saying he's been offered an interview because he's been doing it on his phone. So it's like, well, there you go. It's got many uses, and like you say, probably phone, obviously there's smartphone, and that changes the way it's viewed, but even phone itself doesn't really cut it a lot of the time, thinking about it.
No, it doesn't. It's like I do the podcast generally to and fro way to work, but actually at the same time, like yourself, I'm writing a book. I've got a fictional book and an original non-fiction book as well. So I kind of go into it every so often. I'll hit there and hit the editor, and I'll make sure things sound better, or they're flowing better, or I'm revising through, and I'm browsing through it. And then the crazy things happen when you start getting involved in your own book and you're reading it, and it's like, oh, it's been 10 minutes now. I can
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, you sound similar to me in many ways. In the sense that you always want to be active,
yeah.
And use time productively. And obviously, if you've got a device on you all the time that enables you to even edit videos or could be whatever you want to do, and write, obviously, and organize and push the possibilities of the gadget and the device to do more with your time, then that's a major selling point for me. It sounds like it is for you as well.
It is, yeah.
Do more and more of the time.
And productivity. Oddly enough, I was
maximize time.
Quite a passionate discussion with a lady that I know, and she was, you're just wasting your time, or you're doing all these crazy things. I thought, no, I'm trying to maximize my time, be more efficient.
Yeah.
It's because I do this here, I don't have to do it at a later stage down the line. It's about planning and being organized. So I can have more time to do the things that I need to do.
Yeah. Well, it's about improving the quality of life, isn't it? And using the phone as an enhancing, facilitating tool for your dreams and ideas and desires and plans rather than just sat around wasting time.
That's it. It's all, what can I do to enhance everything? And I love technology for that. I mean, technology has become the... Are we on that very note then? Are we becoming so interconnected with technology that we are part cyborg then?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously some people can scaremonger about, you know, the growing prevalence and integration of technology into our daily lives, you know, and things like Alexa as well, Facebook spying on you, then, you know, pinging you updates about products it's overheard you talking about.
Well, yes.
5 minutes previously. I think there are certain lines in the sand, like I probably wouldn't get Alexa myself. I don't see a huge need for it. Maybe if you're a young family and you need help coordinating everything in a house, possibly it makes more sense then. But
yeah.
I think there are still lines in the sand where you want to have enough capability and input yourself as a human and not be on the phone all the time as well. You know, you still have times where you put it away and you just think and cogitate for yourself every now and again.
Do you think that's actually it, though? If you have Alexa in your house or a similar device, I don't know, like Google Assistant or Siri or all the various ones that are out there, Bixby and stuff, the fact that it's constant listening in your environment, do you think that's where the fear comes, is that it can schedule or be a better parent than the human who should be juggling all these things because it has its organized rota of what's going on, how you're going to do things, or what your shopping's going to be, and it's already got it at the door, and it's monitoring your
freezer
and your freezer.
I think that's part of it. And I think, talking about Edgar Wright again,
sorry,
a bit of a sore throat, but talking about Edgar Wright, say with The World's End, when, you know, the climactic scene, they're talking about basically the human race being too belligerent and bloody-minded to take orders from a kind of an overarching kind of computerized robotic alien race. You know, obviously that they're creating that scenario and riffing on technology in that way for a reason, because it does reflect a lot of modern fears.
Yeah.
But I think it's obviously that done in quite a British way, and that ties back into Union Jack. But I think definitely as a race, not just, you know, the British, but as a race, we're generally so bloody-minded and rebellious and spontaneous and willful and changeable and emotional, and that's part of what makes us human, that we rebel against things that try and control us too much. You know, and if my phone starts telling me too many things to do, I kind of say, well, you know, F you, I'm going to actually do something completely different just to divert from the thing you're trying to prescribe to me to do. I think there's still a balance there. You have to allow enough leeway. I've been guilty of trying to overschedule and control my life with a kind of online plan or a digital plan, and something happens and I think, actually, well, I can't accommodate that anymore. I have to go off the beaten track and do something different. So I think it's just about that balance. Don't rely on anything too much, you know, use it as a facilitating tool, but don't pin everything onto it. And that, in a way, that's contradictory to what we were just saying about getting the maximum out of it, but then I don't know, it's still just about that balance, I guess. In many ways, it can enhance things, and it could be tools of expression as well. It could be Instagram story filters or adding music, or people using Snapchat or whatever it could be that can add to the human experience and sort of enhance memories, but never lose sight, I guess, of what it still means to be human. Who's holding the device?
I do wonder in the future that we're going to look back, so our future ancestors, you know, should we survive the solar minimum or whatever, 80 years down the line, looking back at photographs of today, and everyone's looking at the people with like Snapchat filters and Instagram filters and going, this is what people really looked like back then.
Definitely.
Cat faces, what's all about?
Possibly. I mean, I think, it's just about balance. Some people rail against everything becoming too computerized, and say money as well, but then you can't have the benefits of everything being so convenient because everything's organized digitally without having a lot of your data known about online.
Yeah, I think that's,
you know,
that's the big fear,
without technology being so ever-present. You know, it's, I don't know, you know, say with money, everything's made so much easier generally through, you know, the financial system being digitized and our personal finances being digitized and appified. You can't really argue against it. There are always pros and cons, you know, and you have to make a choice. You want to go back to a typewriter and pen and paper and putting money in a sock under your mattress, you know, and going internet free and living in a shed somewhere? Or do you still want the benefits, being honest with yourself?
Yeah,
you know,
it really is the best of both worlds. You have to dip your toes in both of those areas, I think, to be human, I think, these days.
Yeah, and, you know, things are always changing, things are always evolving, and every generation has its new challenges. But I think the idea of a dystopian future, you know, you can always do monger and say things were better in my day, they used to be better than this. But, you know, really, in lots of ways, life has never been better than it is now, in terms of general quality of life across the board,
in a generalized sense.
So I think it's easy to be just dystopian about some technologized, like the Matrix, but I think that's too pessimistic.
No, I subscribe very much to that view myself, is that where we've got to in terms of technology and the way that things work, and the way we have such interaction and communication, we can talk to people on the other side of the world in an instant, we can communicate in so many different ways, and that, you're right, it's never been better. But unfortunately, that throws up inequality, and I think it's very easy to see what people don't have, and you go, why don't they have it? You know, they can. I think that's a very, the way that the interconnected way of working is highlighting. And I think that's what triggers people's emotions. We need to help everybody.
Yeah.
I
think
that.
It's an important word, highlighting as well, because some people might say, certain issues in the world are worse than they were. It's like, well, are they worse than they were, or are they simply more highlighted now? I think that's a very valid point that people seem to lose sight of, and you can get terrified about the amount of horror stories and worrying statistics there are about anything. Could be poverty, could be crime, could be climate change, could be mental health, could be, I don't know, police numbers or cuts, whatever it is. But a lot of the cause behind it is simply there's more information out there more of the time. They're just more aware of it now, inexorably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess people scare themselves also with statistics as well. And it's 3% more than it was last year. Well, that probably means there's only about 5 more, actually.
Yeah,
and the percentage is a skewed measure. That people go, it's worse than ever. And it's like, well, is it? Let's work it out. Oh, man. So it's been actually really good to talk to you, man. Actually, it's been quite a breath of fresh air, in all fairness, to talk to someone who has, you know, he's actually seen the film side of things, has seen developments, and has got ideas about the way, how the world works in a kind of balanced view. I mean,
Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you as well, Christian. I mean, I think it's impossible to, say, especially engaging with podcasts and, say, with Joe Rogan being a door to so many other, such a variety of thinkers. And my podcast, I have in mind, is similar to what sounds like the format of your podcast is, in terms of conversations and interviews in quite a free-flowing way.
I think
with people from various walks of life, you know, if you consistently expose yourself to that, I don't think there's any way forward but to maintain a deep grounded sense of common sense. You don't get lost in any kind of bubble of ideology that's too extreme on the left or the right, as certain people do, and they disappear down black holes on the internet. You generally keep a very grounded view of the world, and you can accommodate a spectrum in your head without getting too stuck in your ways. And I think that, you know, that way going forward enables you to keep a clear view of things, which is hard with so much white noise out there in the world.
Your vernacular there was very good, by the way. That was certainly the way I would describe how things work as well. And I guess a simpler way there. It's true, when you have a spectrum of viewpoints and understandings of where people come from, and I think there's this, we've lost the ability to communicate. No one sits around a dinner table anymore and goes, what's your view on X, Y, and Z? And people have no, their rabbit holes often are very echo chambers. And in the echo chamber, they just bounce off each other and always scare themselves that there's no other opinions, and if there is no other opinion, it's wrong. Rather than actually, let me understand that view.
But I think, if anything, the biggest merit and value of the wealth of podcasts that are out there is that it does provide more comprehensive and concise information that informs you about the world so that you don't get lost in echo chambers. I think it's probably the biggest antidote and tonic to disappearing into the bubble of white noise that so many people seem to find so tempting and so susceptible to. It's the biggest antidote to that, I find. It enables you to distill as much information as possible, to absorb and distill as much information as possible, as often as possible, so you constantly remain updated and clear-viewed about, well, not the whole world of human endeavors, but as much of it as possible, to make sure you do keep your feet on the ground and make sure you use the internet and the phone as a tool for you rather than be used by it and do disappear into some echo chamber and get lost in some flame war and interminable argument with someone else on Twitter or some forum or wherever. We end up just trolling each other for post after post because you're clashing on some subject that you're both approaching from, you know, way to the side of the spectrum.
Yeah, the common ground. I always say the most interesting thing about people is that they have so many similarities that they don't realize it. It's like, we've all stepped up the stairs.
Yeah.
We've all taken one too many steps at the top of the stairs, and we all lay on the pillow and wonder, yeah, how come the pillow goes up and down no matter which eye I've got closed? The silly things that actually we all bring us together, we can laugh about, and then go, you can say, well, so let me understand this view that you have. And it almost like appears that there's a release of just like, I can have this discussion with somebody. It's a really powerful thing to see when someone offloads an idea and the other person goes, well, wait a minute. I know for a fact this part can't happen. And they go, that's true. And they kind of, you both grow as people. You grow as communicators and educators. And from that point on, you've gained trust in each other and you've become better people.
Well, yeah, and you're using reason and compassion rather than, you know, simply running on hair trigger animality, impulse, and emotion, which doesn't do anyone any favors. It just means you stay on your side of the fence, and they stay on their side of the fence, and you just chuck bricks at each other, which leads nowhere. Right. You know, it's weird how in 5 to 10 years, like you say, you know, generally people don't sit down and talk to each other anymore, or things like echo chambers and ideology bubbles have become a lot more prevalent and much more of a problem, with people just one side trolling the other on the internet, and then it plays out into the streets in terms of elections and things like that, and could lead to protests, crime, you know, shootings, whatever horrific thing it could lead to. And like, I think that's probably grown apace in the last decade or so. But I think with it, as the best antidote to it that I found so far, is wealth of podcasts and other forms of long-form media that, you know, say, actually, let's calm down and let's talk about things for a couple of hours. And let's try and, like you say, reason it out like normal people. And remember that we are all our people, and to not lose sight of it, and just to listen.
There was a quote from somebody, and it's going to really bug me, I don't know what it is. They described a situation at war. Is that eventually we're going to go to war because we have different ideology, and then we're going to sit around a table and talk about it, and then take our troops away. Why not, instead of fighting in the first place, we just talk now? To stop everyone dying, and it's like, that's kind of resonated for quite some time. Instead of there being a conflict, let's just talk about it now.
Yeah, definitely. But I don't know. Some people just seem to really bad and need their heads banged together, and you know, it's so often the pendulum seems to swing too far, you know, to the right or to the left, whatever it might be. And people, you know, I'm still worried about what I say now to a degree, because so many people have such strong opinions and they voice them so vociferously these days. Obviously, there's so many different kinds of examples of people apologizing online, on social media, or in person when they said something that upsets some demographic. Yeah. And even if it is rational, because the people think their opinion's now validated because they've got the online platform, they think they deserve an apology. And then companies, public figures, whoever they could be, you know, have to make groveling apologies when there's a storm of outrage and backlash, even if it isn't rational.
Yeah, and you know, you're absolutely right on the money with that. That is ever present. You know, every time I kind of look at the internet, that's something I kind of see, and I'm like, come on, you know, I let the guy have an opinion, or let her have an opinion, let her.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
that is just as valid as the other person who's upset about it. You know, there's
yeah,
the
I think
right
it's
to be
one of the most. Yeah, just one of the most pernicious parts of the internet, I think. You know, all it does is it fuel the march towards more and more wall in echo chambers,
yeah,
which is dangerous.
Very much so. I think it challenges everything.
Yeah, yeah. It creates fences and divisions, which does no one any favours.
No, it really doesn't. So I was actually just looking back at my notes there about the some of the stuff I took down through the episode. I watched of episode one of Union Jack. And one thing I really noticed was the music. It actually was really good.
Yeah, very, very good.
So is it?
Yeah, the guy behind it, very, very talented. Multi-instrumentalist. He's been making music for many years. And it's a real coup to get him involved in the project because, yeah, such talent, such, I don't know, such an ear for melody, so many original ideas, you know, and he's managed to cover the variety of different sounds you'd need for a show like this, of this scale, you know, moments of stealth, moments of intrigue, moments of heavy, rocking action, moments of quiet and emotion, and he's covered all the bases very impressively.
Yeah, so what, is he a band, or is he a group, or is he an individual who's managed to push this together?
His name is Bill Hooper, and the name of his band is Tasha Fights Tigers, and they can be found on Bandcamp.
Yeah, because like you said, the variety of music cues, instrumental within there, was really quite astounding for a fan production. I was just like, this music quality is extraordinarily good.
Yeah, he really went to town on this, and he and the director, Mark, longtime friends and collaborators, and Mark kind of went to him and said, you know, here's the brief, and then Bill just dedicated his time to scoring the entire piece and was always coming up with new ideas and sending over new sounds and examples and different themes and melodies, sonic themes. It was super impressive.
Yeah, that's actually what I took away most of the episode, obviously, is your performance as a lead character, the bands that you guys had, and the music. And actually, the graphic style itself actually was really good. I mean, I'm assuming you guys are quite proficient in the world of video editing, but the graphics and style I was pleasantly impressed with. Again, this is really good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, we tried to throw as much of it, you know, as we could as possible at the show to make it as authentic and believable as possible and as high quality as possible.
Well, that's the thing about fan productions. I guess that the production tools are now accessible for everyone. I guess, you know, like I say, Adobe's suite is like, what, £50 a month? That's actually quite accessible if you're a filmmaker. You have a variety of tools within that, and cameras these days are relatively inexpensive to produce something of high quality that's broadcast quality.
Yeah, well, like I say, that was the aim we were going for, and to make it look as best as it possibly could, and to make people wonder, how the hell did they do this? You know, how they managed to find, you know, the time and the ingenuity and the resources to put this much together. We wanted to really impress people with what we could do, what you can do on a low budget if you really are as resourceful as possible.
Yeah, I did notice the abundance of lens flare in there, so...
Yeah, Well, chucking some lens flare in a modern production.
That's kind of the standard staple, isn't it, these days? It's going to have lens flare in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's funny, just to tie it into what we were talking about before, one of the points for me of doing Brexit was to provide a cultural antidote to, or a cultural or pop cultural protest to the, excuse me, to the white noise around Brexit and the division that's sprung up in the country around it, was just to make it, to make a stand, I suppose, for union, effectively, because he's Union Jack, to make a bid for unity and to try and make people forget their divisions and their ideological bubbles for a moment and kind of unite in the name of entertainment, watching the show, and to remember that we are all one nation, and can't we, as we, you and I talked about just now, get along a bit better and talk a bit more and listen to each other and focus on unity rather than division.
You know, I can't say, I can't say that and agree with that any higher than I already have. That is that, that is straight on the money there with, again, a really good vernacular. That is, in many ways, I think that's probably the best place to actually, is to end a kind of conversation like this. That's the best place to actually leave it on a high, as it were, and go, this
all right.
We should have people come together, and we should celebrate coming together and not being at each other's throats and arguing over semantics and politics.
Yeah.
With each other.
And the best about, you know, kind of the best of British as well, are the best things about being British and Britain and focusing on the good rather than the bad, or how your neighbour's different to you in this way or neighbour's different to you in that way. Basically, you know, just to try and settle that aside for half an hour each week.
True, it's true. So what have you got coming up then? What's next for you in there?
Well, like I say, I plan to focus on the podcast. There's a novel I've written as well that I want to send off to agents. And there's to see what acting opportunities come up from the release of Union Jack. I'd like to pursue those as well.
Awesome. So is there any, so before we head off here, so is there any kind of links or website addresses you want to leave for people who are interested in this, who could find out more about yourself and the team behind the production, the production themselves?
Sure. Well, when it comes to Union Jack, you can go on the official Facebook page, Union Jack the Series. We're on YouTube as well, obviously, under Union Jack the Series. Instagram, Union Jack the Series. You can go to the director's website for more information as well and see his other films. That's markgarvey.co.uk. You can go to my personal Facebook page for updates on the various things I'm doing, which is Sam O'Hara Childs. And then Sam O'Hara Childs on YouTube to see some of the short films I've made, and Instagram and Twitter as well.
So what's this window all about? This is my melting pot home to different kinds of content, the things that interest me, products that I'm presently doing or have been involved with. I have a thirst for knowledge, inspiration, adventure and discovery. There's presentations, talks, completed film projects, documentary material, edits of some of the live performances that I've been the videographer and the editor behind, accessible how-tos and blog content. I have a passion for exploring our curious world. That has led to the creation of the video and audio podcast that I produce and host called Our Curious World, about having genuine conversations with guests across various topics, engaging with people, inspired by the Joe Rogan Experience and Coast to Coast AM. I love talking about the things that have us asking questions and learning along the way. We really do live in interesting and fascinating times. I have a history involved with the research of the unexplained, all things Fortean. You'll also find the 24-episode radio series Rabbit Hole That Is Reality that I produced through 2013 and 14, which are available on this channel to listen to as well. I'm an avid gamer, artist, creative, who's not afraid to experiment, be silly, and let my hair down, as it were. So join me on this journey figuring stuff out and producing material along the way. Hit up a like, a subscribe, and join the conversation.